couple of days later on a different show, you denounced white supremacy.
No,
my question to you is,
you've done this to me and everybody.
Why does it seem like
I denounced white supremacy? Okay,
you did 2 days later.
I've denounced white supremacy for years.
Welcome back, Jordana here. That was President Trump last night during his town hall on NBC, where that was the first time we have heard him actually denounce white supremacy. Because a few weeks ago, when he was asked to denounce white supremacy and groups like the Proud Boys, here's what he said.
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists
who would
right
you like me to condemn?
White
Proud
supremacists
Boys.
And right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
So again, the stand back and stand by is now the rally call for the Proud Boys. They have swag on their website and Facebook sites about it. Definitely a dog whistle to them and not a denunciation. I'm so excited to talk to my next guest. Talia Lavin is the author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. She didn't just study them and write a book about them. She became one of them. But in the good way, don't worry, she was not spouting hate. But she wanted to really understand them. So she posed as members of these white supremacist groups to really learn about what makes them tick. I'm so excited that she's here joining us on the show to sort of take us into this world a little bit. Talia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
I'm so happy that you're here. I grew up in Parsippany, and all my friends from camp grew up in Teaneck. You probably went to Solomon Schechter with them.
No, I didn't, but I definitely know Solomon Schechter well. And
that's a school.
All day.
We certainly could. That's a Jewish school in New Jersey for those of my listeners here in Minnesota. But again, we could do the Jewish geography another time. But Talia, why would you want to do this? This is such a deep, disgusting, dirty underworld of troubled people. What motivated you?
Well, you know, as sort of an outspoken Jewish woman who for several years has been speaking out against the growth of the white power movement, I was already a target of a lot of their vitriol and had received sort of countless slurs and threats and all kinds of nasty stuff. And my reaction was, instead of sort of turning away and disappearing and letting them drive me away from having a public voice, I decided that if the abyss was already looking at me, I would turn and turn my gaze on them and learn as much as I could and expose as much as I could in an effort to truly understand the threat that we're facing.
How did you do it?
So I spent a lot of time kind of lurking undercover in a lot of white supremacist chat rooms, both public and private, many on the encrypted app Telegram, which is sort of the haven for white supremacists. I infiltrated a couple of different organizations and kinds of groups, from sort of Christian extremists to incels. Those are involuntarily celibate men, as they call themselves, who are radicalized misogynists. And I also studied a lot of the history of the white power movement, its antecedents, and sort of what are the historical analogs to and sources for the current rising white power movement.
All right, so you got to tell us, what did you learn? Who are these people, these, you know, involuntary celibate people that probably just don't have the courage to go find a girlfriend or maybe a boyfriend? Who are these people and how do they get to this dark place?
So, you know, I think for maybe a lot of your listeners, and it's certainly endemic to a lot of the people I talk to, you know, just this morning I had someone say, like, oh, you know, shouldn't they just get laid? Wouldn't you just with one of them just to get them out of the movement? And I think there's really a misconception and a really kind of a dangerous one. You know, people want to believe that people who are members of the white power movement are inherently sort of poor or ignorant or disenfranchised in ways that go beyond, you know, what other people are, that they almost have a motive for the hate they spread by sort of unique damage or trauma. And from sort of a very up close and personal look, you know, about 2 years of really intense immersion in these spaces, including spending a great deal of time catfishing on a white supremacist-only dating site, I found that that's really not the case. You have people from all different walks of life. There were people who were software engineers, people who were in the military, people with quite high levels of educational attainment. And the conversations that I was eavesdropping on that were ostensibly sort of private, they didn't know I was looking in. You know, of course, the level of dialogue was quite coarse and puerile and shot through with racial invective. But they were also trading texts with one another, including phrenology texts from the 19th century, interwar Romanian fascist novels. They were creating audiobooks for each other. I mean, this idea that, you know, in order to join the white power movement, it's solely people who are poorer than anyone I know or less educated than anyone I know. It couldn't be anyone on my street or in my neighborhood or someone I know or admire. You know, I think that's a really fatal misconception. It's led to a lot of really poor journalism on the movement that sort of looks at figures like Richard Spencer, you know, the head of the racist think tank, the National Policy Institute, as sort of these remarkable figures. Oh my goodness, a dapper Nazi, a Nazi and astute. But I'm not, you know, surprised by an eloquent or wealthy Nazi. I think there are people in the white the people in the white power movement, you know, while they have chosen and continue to choose to make human choices to inflict harm and pain, these are people just like everyone else. It could be your coworker. It could be someone in your neighborhood. You know, there's no markers that will, you know, it's not toothless Cletus in a basement. That's really a classist myth. And it's also a myth of sort of self-absolution. You know, it's a way for people to say, oh, it can't be like anyone I know. And that's just not the case.
We're speaking, of course, with Talia Levin. She is the author of the book Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. So how did these people get this way? And what was Talia's experience like being on a white supremacist dating site? And then, of course, lessons learned from the dark web. Talia and I will continue the conversation next. Welcome back. It's 419. Jordana here. We're speaking with Talia Levin. She is the author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. And Talia did not just study them for her book. She became one of them. She assumed a range of identities, a blonde Nazi babe, a violent Aryan femme fatale. She went on a whites-only dating website geared toward racists. Looking for love, she found a YouTube channel run by a 14-year-old girl with over 800,000 followers. And Talia, you know, to hear you continuing the conversation, if you didn't hear the beginning, use radio.com and do the rewind feature. But thanks for hanging with us through the break. Talia, to hear you say that these people are regular people, they're software engineers, they're military, they're highly educated, is actually really troubling for me, because to have that kind of hate in your heart, I would assume you are damaged. You've been, I don't know, you know, a victim of violence or trauma or something like that. Did you find any underlying thread with these people which would make them have so much hate?
Well, you know, I think it's a really natural impulse to want to otherize white supremacists, members of the white power movement. And, you know, it's one of the things that I really, one of the stereotypes that I really set out to dismantle in my work, because it's something that I just encountered so plainly in, you know, the spaces I was infiltrating, that these were really regular, ordinary people that could be, you know, in the next cubicle over from you trading photos of lynchings and like their baseball cards and laughing. And so, you know, I think we want to believe, you know, it's a very common idea that there's a unique sort of set of traumas that would lead someone to sort of set out to create a worse, more hateful world. But in fact, I think that impulse is self-protective, especially when it comes from people who are white. You know, I myself carry a lot of trauma. People of color carry a disproportionate amount of trauma in this country. And yet trauma itself doesn't lead people into the white supremacist movement per se. And in fact, many of the people opposing it have led difficult lives. You know, certainly white supremacists don't have a monopoly on trauma. The commonality I found, you know, I think what sort of was a consistent thread was that these are human people who make human choices, and they make the human choice every day to inculcate hate in their hearts and to exercise that hate with, you know, harassment, both digital and physical, of people they perceive to be their race enemies, myself included as a Jewish woman. And this is a, you know, these are human choices that they make. And I don't think their humanity absolves them. To the contrary, I think it damns them further, because these are choices they've made to use our shared humanity and to use it to make, you know, a world that they want to see washed in blood. That being said, you know, the white supremacist movement, the white power movement, has a lot of its own mythology. You know, no fascist movement, no nationalism, you know, no movement of any kind really can exist without a sort of carapace of ideology to protect it. And in the case of the white power movement, you have, you know, they're drawing on both, you know, older texts, like, for example, the Crusades operate as a big sort of lost cause, almost like a neo-Confederate lost cause for a lot of white supremacists, you know, who want to see a total civilizational conflict, you know, who are driven by Islamophobia and fear of refugees, and this idea that, you know, that the white race is being outbred. And so, you know, some of them draw on the Crusades, some of them draw on phrenology and pseudoscience, but all of them have this idea that what they're doing is noble, that what they're doing is in service of a greater cause, the protection and preservation of the white race against its many enemies. And so, you know, what I saw was a really sophisticated world of propaganda meant to make people believe that they were heroes for engaging in a struggle that ultimately involved harming many people in many different ways.
Is their goal violence? Did you see any of these conversations actually, you know, come to fruition in an act of violence?
So because many of the spaces I was infiltrating were public, you know, I didn't see sort of specific planning of acts of violence. Mm-hmm. But there's a kind of violence that's called stochastic terror, which is the idea of sort of seeding the notion of violence in people's minds, seeding the necessity of violence and the glory of violence. And that was just absolutely everywhere in all of these spaces. You know, constant barrage of propaganda to the point that we're fighting a race war, that you have to get armed, that you have to prepare yourself for the coming race war or boogaloo, as they sometimes call it. Yep. And, you know, a constant barrage of real incitement to violence. And, you know, while I wasn't in a chat with either Patrick Crucius, who gunned down 22 people at an El Paso Walmart last year, or Robert Bowers, who allegedly murdered 11 Jews in Pittsburgh in 2018, I was surfing some of the same online spaces that they had frequented. So, you know, I think when you have an environment so rife with stochastic terror, so rife with the idea that sort of only you can save the white race through violence, it's only a matter of time before people you know, take them up on it. And what we see as a result are mass casualty events.
So what can we do? You've shined the light through your book on these groups that we all know exist, but you really took it to the next level. I mean, what can we do? Is there any hope of educating these people? Is there any hope of protecting us from themselves? I mean, is there any hope that social media will be regulated enough that they will go on these underground dark webs and root them out? I mean, what can we do?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to have a bouquet of solutions available to you, but this may be a bit controversial for your audience, but you know, there's been a lot of really misleading chatter about Antifa, anti-fascism. And the book has two chapters about anti-fascism and sort of the people I view as the everyday heroes of the anti-fascist movement. There are a lot of sort of news clips of people dressed in black, maybe shattering windows. I think this is a very biased view of what the anti-fascist movement is. People I've met, and I consider myself the anti-fascist. And a lot of what anti-fascists do is research, actually. It's about looking in your town, in your community, with the hope of defending your community, seeing who's a member of an organized racist group. Maybe going a little bit further, checking out, you know, that dubious guy on Facebook, you know, who's always posting racist things and seeing if, you know, maybe his employer should know about it. You know, I think the biggest form of immunization we can give ourselves is to reimpose the social cost of bigotry. I think, you know, given the leadership we have in the White House and the sort of steadily eroding social cost of naked, even violent racism, I think the best thing we can do to immunize ourselves is to deputize ourselves in the war against the white power movement, even at cost to ourselves. But to say, you know, hate has no home here, but beyond, you know, beyond a yard sign, beyond an empty slogan, to genuinely say, you know, bigotry is not acceptable and should have consequences. And we each have, you know, history demands of us, this moment demands of us that we each step forward and, you know, seek to defend our communities against the rising forces of the white power movement. And it's incumbent on all of us to do so.
Talia Lavin, author of Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. The book just came out a few days ago. New York Times loved it, so congratulations on that great review. And thank you for doing this deep dive, for putting yourself at risk and out there. And I hope this does shine a bright light to show people the kind of hate that truly does exist, and have everybody else call it out, because then we can bring the light together. So, Talia, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you, Minneapolis. Take care.
You got it. The book is everywhere, of course. Again, it's called Culture Warlords, My Journey into the Dark Web of White Supremacy. Just fascinating. A lot of bravery. She's a young woman, and she really did put herself out there. We'll lighten things up on CCO when we return. Some fun stories next. Yes, we need a little getaway from the negative news, white supremacists, politics. We need a little break. So, Dan, how about this one? Man shelters 300 dogs from Hurricane Delta. This is great. I mean, the thought of sheltering 300 dogs in your home, I can sort of smell it from here.
Oh, I mean, my goodness.
Can't, yeah.
And that's just the dog smell. Never mind the what comes out of the dog smell.
So, yeah, as the dangerous Hurricane Delta closed in on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, Richard Pimentel opened his home to about 300 dogs. And by the way, there were some other critters, too. Dozens of cats were harbored in his son's room. His daughter's room served as a refuge for chicks and bunnies and even a hedgehog. And the patio became a haven for a flock of sheep. And yes, he agrees, it did smell terrible, but it was worth it because everybody, all of the animals and the family, thank God, survived the storm. He said the home can be cleaned, but you can't replace the animal. October 6th.
Can it? I mean, after a point, that smell's just sort of in there, and you can Stanley steam clean everything you want, but it ain't coming out.
I don't, I don't know that you can zero res that.
Yeah, I don't think you
can. I think that you'd have to call the new carpet company and
I think you have to burn the whole house down is what you have to do.
So there's that. The reason he had access to so many animals is because he founded a shelter about a decade ago, about 20 miles southwest of Cancun, where he lives with his family on the property of the shelter. But he was worried that the shelter wasn't going to hold up well and the animals would be scared and alone. So he moved them all into his home. Isn't that fantastic? He says he always preferred the company of animals. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, so he says some 500 animals live on nearly 10 acres of land in and around the shelter. But hopefully, now that this great story has made it national, people will adopt the animals.
He's hoping they do.
I know, right? Get them out of the house.
Get them out. I mean, God bless him for saving all those animals. That's great.
I know.
Are you a big fan of the Queen? Queen Elizabeth, you a big fan?
She seems lovely.
Yeah.
I don't watch the show, though.
Not the show. I mean, I'm not talking about the show. I'm talking about the actual Queen of England.
Are you a fan? She seems, I guess, okay.
Okay, well, she's catching a little heat.
All I know is that she waves funny. Uh-oh, what'd she do?
Catching a little heat. So the Queen attended her first public engagement outside of a royal residence since March. But the 94-year-old monarch was without a face covering, despite being at greater risk of severe illness from COVID-19 due to her age.
Yeah.
So she was joined
Do that?
Well, that's a great question, right? They're waiting for an answer. She was joined by her grandson, the Duke of Cambridge, at the Defense Science and Technology Laboratory at Portendown near Salisbury, meeting scientists who are providing vital support in the UK's response to the COVID-19 outbreak. So she's visiting scientists who are working on helping the UK prevent COVID-19, and she's there in one of her queen outfits, one of her standard queen regalia, and neither she nor Prince William were wearing a mask at the time.
I don't get that.
They were socially distanced. They were standing apart from everybody.
Come on, though. You got to set the example.
That's what I would say.
Better judgment.
Isn't that the whole point of the Queen at this point, is just setting an example for people?
That's all she does.
The entirety of her existence?
It's the waving and the example setting.
Yeah.
Wow. I can see why, though. I can see why. I mean, there's such a surge in Europe.
Yeah.
I can totally see why. And that was the wrong choice for her to make. And she's 94, for God's sake.
That's what I'm saying. There's no truth to the rumor that Charles actually encouraged her to go out without a mask.
It's terrible. Right? Isn't he? I mean, I know that's maybe terrible to say, but right? He's like, okay, 94. Do I ever get to be the king?
That's a question. That's a question.
Ever get to be the king? Long live the queen. She should have longevity and not get COVID, but wear your damn mask,
wear a mask.
My God. Dan, I know you live modestly. You have a bachelor pad, but have you ever thought about living out your life in a van to save money?
A van down by the river?
By the river. I don't think it needs to be near a river, but get this. Van life is becoming more appealing to Americans during COVID-19. 52% of Americans considered living full-time or part-time in RVs or camper vans outfitted with amenities like bed, stove, storage units, bathroom, Wi-Fi. Doesn't really sound like roughing it, according to a new survey from move.org. They say that they would consider the nomadic lifestyle. The economic uncertainty has impacted their decisions. The motivating factor, 72% of respondents say they would trade the comfort of their own home to pay off debt. It's a motivator.
That's a motivator for a lot of people. So there's two things that come immediately to mind. Number one, for folks that are on TikTok, there are all kinds of videos all over TikTok now of people refurbishing either vans or old school buses. But, I mean, decking them out so that they are livable quarters and they can just drive around and live in these buses and in these vans. So I'm not surprised to hear that, one. Mm-hmm. Two, for those people that missed it earlier today, Shaletta Brundage was on, our good friend Shaletta Brundage was on the Chad Hartman show. Feisty Fridays with Shaletta is always at 105, unless we have to move her, and then she gets very mad at me when I have to do that.
But she gets feisty.
She does get very feisty at that point. But, of course, Shaletta just went down to Louisiana and brought a bunch of books and was trying to do some hurricane relief down there. So they're on the way back, her and her husband and her family, in the RV.
Mm-hmm.
And she's talking about this RV going, you know, we got TVs on the inside, we got TVs on the outside, we got facilities, we got all this stuff. You know, if Sean ever wises up and leaves me, he can actually live in this thing.
Oh, God.
So apparently it's crossed Shaletta's mind, or maybe it's crossed Sean's mind. We keep threatening we're going to rescue Sean at some point.
Yeah, I know. Free Sean.
Well, free Sean, but he's got to make us cinnamon rolls in the process. That's part of the bit.
Right.
He did make a batch for me, allegedly, at one point. They never actually made it to me. They were intercepted in between.
Story.
I just want to remind folks of that in case they want to put a little pressure on Shalette and Sean to come through on that.
Well, they do have four kids, for God's sake.
They do.
I've seen that RV.
Yeah.
It is like the Taj Mahal
right? Of
RVs. It was given to her by Marcus Lemoines, who owns Camping World. And Sean could live there. That whole family could live there. And remember, I went RVing this summer, but this is like super fantastical dreamland RV. Yeah. This is, she is working that RV. I mean, she is, of course, using it for good. She's going down there to donate books and do the Lord's work. She's so great. But
Jordana, have you ever been to Australia?
Yes, of course. I took a CCO trip to Australia. Okay. What a great, great trip. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm never going to Australia, and it's a bit on the Chad Hartman Show we talk about all the time, that it's too long a flight. I don't want any part of that flight. And there's all kinds of crazy stuff that happens down there, okay? Including...
like the fires?
Fires would be one thing. This is actually... I would take the fires over this next story. A brave reptile lover who tried to rescue a rogue snake from under her car was forced to dial 000, which is Australia's 911, for help when the python coiled itself around her leg.
Stop it.
Queensland police were called to a home near Samford Valley, northwest of Brisbane, after the woman became entangled with the 2 to 3 meter long carpet python.
No.
The woman had been working in her garage at 7 p.m. on October 6th when she noticed her cat had cornered a snake under a car. First of all, how does a cat corner the snake?
Right?
The self-confessed snake lover went to rescue the wild reptile from being attacked, but quickly it turned on her. The carpet python wrapped its tail around the woman's leg and constricted, prompting her to call emergency services to help her remove the python. I'm not going.
I get that, because they do have some strange critters down there.
More than a few.
And yeah, even the kangaroos can be mean if they're threatened and they look sweet. And even those koalas, oh man, they'll rip your head off, rip a couple of fingers off.
Yeah.
They can be mean.
Not going to Australia.
I loved my trip. Yeah. It was a great trip with CCO. But we would see snakes. Like, we'd be in the bus, and we'd see the snakes on the side of the road. Like,
it's a thing.
I don't blame you. I wouldn't last a minute. That boa would snap me in two.
Probably.
Oh, my God. All right. Good. I'm glad I went and came back alive. When we get back, Mike Max is going to be joining us. Sports with Maxie next. The NFL has some new COVID rules. So, are the Vikings and Falcons still on for Sunday? All of your burning sports questions are about to be answered by our own Mike Max. Hello, love.
Jor, how are you?
I'm great.
It's good to
how
hear
are
your
you?
Voice any day, but on a Friday after a long week, it always is great to commit with you.
Amen, brother. Amen. Were you out in the hail this morning?
I was sitting having coffee about 8 o'clock this morning. And I saw these people, like an aghast look on their face. And I turned, and they're looking out the window, and the snow was coming down, you know. And people left the coffee shop with their phones in hand to take pictures. It was kind of cool. A Minnesota moment, you know.
We all did that. Like, yeah. I was astounded to see how giant the flakes were falling
were
outside
big.
My... Yeah, and then the hail. So, of course, I did take a little video. But now it looks like a gorgeous fall day, so
I was just walking to downtown Minneapolis, which will make you depressed any time these days. But the cool, crisp, I like a fall day. I like a change of seasons. I like all of that. I like that. I embrace that about living in Minnesota, the fact that it's going to get colder. I know it's going to get colder, but I like that transition time. It just is a little bit tough when there's four squad cars parked on the sidewalks while you're walking, and they're just there to prevent any damage, you know?
Yeah, it's a tough time in downtown Minneapolis right now.
Some good deals, though. Got a pair of trousers for $12 and a tie for $6, and they'll both hold up well. Ooh. So I said there is. I just ran to Dr. Michael Osterholm's over here at the TV station. We were talking. Oh. I said there's one advantage to being in the middle of a hole, and that is that you can get some good deals on clothes.
I love that about you, Mikey. Always a bright side, my friend. We travel downtown to sometimes go to Candyland, me and the kids. We love that.
And there's
place.
Only one of those left now. One is out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to go there today, in fact, and I forgot it. You know, one's closed down.
So can we talk a little sports?
You bet.
Because that's what people are talking about. You and I can talk Candyland in a minute.
That's what I was going to get, just for the record, but go ahead.
Love him. So what's going on Sunday? Are the Vikings going to play?
The official that Dalvin Cook will not play. They certainly anticipate playing on Sunday unless Atlanta comes up with some kind of a reason to COVID spread more. They practiced today, though. Julio Jones, their standout receiver, practiced. So it sure looks like whatever situation they have out there, they have under control. And I assume they do have it under control because there's just so many different ways and methods and testing and all that they're doing in the NFL that I assume that if they get a green light to practice on a Friday, that means they have passed a series of tests. I don't think they make it easy on you to just progress at your own pace, so to speak. I think you got to prove it to some people medically, and I think they have. In fact, Dave Lee and I were talking about this morning, Jordan. I would say that in a strange way, and I don't know that this is going to be severely detrimental, but you know, at the high school level, they play football every week, and they can't test these kids every day like they do in the NFL. So no. There's probably a greater risk of them catching it, contracting it. There's no cases that prove that they get gravely ill from it in Minnesota so far, you know, of the high school age kids. But I would think that, you know, they can't afford to test these kids and
no.
They don't have it. So,
no.
So they're just kind of winging it, you know, but I do think the demographic plays in their favor.
Yeah. I mean, they might do like the temperature checks. They might be doing
that. Yes, they could do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I understand it, phase one. I do that every day at the health club when you go in, you know. It's kind of funny. It's like you know you're going to pass the test, but when it pops up at 97.2, it's like, yes, victory. You know, if, I don't know what it is, but it's like this little win you get, you know.
It's like a big relief.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. You won. You won the temperature
lottery. You won
today
for an hour, yep.
Kevin Garnett was in town.
Yeah.
Is he going to buy the Timberwolves?
I would call him a long shot. I think he would really like that. I think it's more difficult than that. The guy in Tennessee has been the leading candidate. I forget his name, but he's been in touch with him before, so he knows more about this situation. Garnett, although, you know, that being said, Garnett could, you know, he's in a position where he could insert himself into any group that becomes a front runner. It's not like he needs to be tied to one group. At some point in time, if an ownership group that's going to get the team likes Kevin Garnett, they could certainly bring him in as a partner if they felt that would help get a deal done. It's a little bit disingenuous, I think, because, you know, Garnett was so angry and so upset with Glenn Taylor for so long, and then all of a sudden one day he realizes he maybe get on ownership, and he says, let's bury the hatchet. Well, you know, Glenn had buried the hatchet a long time ago, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that'll do it.
Yep.
And I'd like to throw this in before we leave. Maple Grove's 2-0 start after a 26-14 win over Blaine. Wink, wink from Dan Cook. So that was exciting in high school football.
Yeah, but Osseo's his team because he's an Osseo grad.
Yeah. Yes, but his
brother. I've got blood at Maple Grove.
Grove. Okay, that's right.
Invested with the Crimson at this point.
And his nephew plays there.
Oh, okay, yeah.
To be fair, I led with there was a lot of high school football action last night, lots of stuff going on, and then I might, you know, direct your attention towards Maple Grove's 2-0 start.
But I just went for the goods.
You went for the goods. I got you.
Yep. I just went right to
yep,
it. And you know I don't mess around.
Last week it was 80 degrees for Maple Grove to play, and last night it was whatever, and tonight, you know, it's 35, you know. Welcome to Minnesota football.
That's crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. Now, I'm reading also Minnesota United is having trouble getting their games in because of COVID.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
But today they had another positive, a negative test. You got to be careful how you say this, right?
Right.
They tested negative as a team today. So they will practice tomorrow in small groups, in pods. So that's, again, a good sign. In an era of small victories, that's a good sign. That they can do that. But tomorrow they'll be able to practice again in smaller pods. So they have missed the last two games because of COVID and are working, obviously, on trying to get that because they had Chicago flying to town. And now, you know, they're talking to Dr. Bill McGuire, one of the owners. He says, we're now flying charter. We didn't used to do that. We're doing some different things to try to make it happen.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, in the 45 seconds we have left, the Candyland on 7th Avenue is still open,
yes, it
right?
is. Yes.
Okay.
Wait,
now, other location.
7th
well.
Is, but it's 9th. Was it 9th that's closed down now?
Oh, is that one closed?
One of the two is closed.
Okay. All right. I'll have to make a pilgrimage.
Yes, but one of them is open, and like I said, chocolate-covered pizza.
Mike Max, we love you. Keep
you
eating
too.
That
have
candy.
A great weekend.
Stay safe, my friend. We will be back with a wrap-up of Dueling Town Halls next.